Mr. Heald, Reel 8. We were talking about this problem you'd had advancing down the front of a hill, and you were telling me how you wanted a troop up there, you only had one tank, and you were explaining the reason for that.
Which I think was proved by the events that happened. In fact, I reversed up the hill, got myself into a turret down position, and I then presumably reported back what had happened. I think by then I satisfied Sergeant Collis's crew had gone out of their tank, and I then set out to find out what had happened to Sergeant Anderson's crew. There was a beech wood at the top of the hill, and I went along the front edge of this beech wood, and eventually I came to Gordon Fidler, who was the driver. In fact, he was very surprised to see me, incredibly grateful, but anyhow, I found he was all right, and I found the others were all right, and so eventually, although we had lost two tanks, one tank completely lost, and the other tank bogged down in the bomb crater, nobody had been wounded at all in this episode. Later in the day, Sergeant Bennett, who was the leader sergeant, went out in the armored recovery vehicle to the tank, not as is suggested in the squadron diary after dark, but in the middle of the afternoon, got out of the armored recovery vehicle, pressed the starter of the tank, and drove it out of the bomb crater. But I think it's right to say that the really Sergeant Bennett in particular, with the armored recovery vehicles, were absolutely excellent. The armored recovery vehicle was a Sherman hull with the turret taken out, which could be used to tow a tank, which could be take the fitted out to a tank was disabled, and the breech tanks out, and were always on the scene, and exceedingly useful if you were in trouble. Now, that was the end of that, and I suppose next day I had more or less a complete troop again, though Sergeant Anderson, who had never been my troop sergeant before, I think went back to somewhere in 82, and I probably continued to have Sergeant Collis, and I think possibly Hobson to go was corporal. Hobson was probably my wireless operator after that time.
Now, just a small incident I wanted to ask you about is in your account, is there was another accidental firing, and when there was something wrong with your driver's hatch. Could you tell us that story? What exactly happened?
Yes, it must have happened after Tommy Smith was killed, and just shows how easy it is for things to go wrong. One day we were in, during the day, and we were in a farm or something like that. I know that all of us except the gunner were looking into the driver's hatch. I don't know whether there was something wrong or what we were looking at. But suddenly, the gunner must have pressed the trigger of the beater, which hadn't been cleared, and fired about four or five shots. In fact, they must have passed within 3 or 4 inches of one of our heads, because we were all so close, and it's immediately beside the driver's hatch. It's on the Indian gates, and I said, how important it is that one should actually clear one's guns when one goes into harbour. But fortunately, nothing happened on that occasion.
Did you use your machine guns much in action? You mentioned that you used to fire into the hedges,
yes,
and such like buildings a lot as you went along. Yes. Would you fire your machine guns in there as well?
Oh, it's the machine guns weren't
better. Not the main guns. Sorry, I've misunderstood that.
It,
yes.
It was entirely the machine guns. And we fired thousands of rounds of machine guns. I mean, I suppose most days after we've been in action, we would have to refill with 30 or 40 boxes of machine guns.
Now, going back to the chronology, the next thing really is the 19th of April, which is the time when you were actually hit by a bazooka, which you've mentioned, but I'd like you now to tell the story in as much detail as possible. Were you proceeding in your normal way, machine gunning the sites, or what happened?
We were certainly the reserve troop originally, and Corporal Bush had been killed. He can't have gone along the road. He must have been in the woods somehow. Anyhow, we were ordered to go along the road. We proceeded in the usual way. It is possible that I was the first tank. It's possible I was the second tank. Certainly, I was going through this wood at a reasonable speed, probably not too fast, probably firing. But I was hit by a bazooka. There was a flash. I knew I'd been bazookaed. I ordered bazooka driver speed up. In fact, I switched on to transmit, so the whole of the regiment heard I'd been bazookaed. But we speeded up and got through the wood. I think the following tank probably got through, and I think there may have been one in front of me. Anyhow, when we could, we got out to see what had happened.
What was it like, before we go into it, because I know, what was it like in the tank when a bazooka hit? I mean, is there a big explosion or any sensation?
Well, the adrenaline starts running, but...
Is there a big bang?
There was a big bang, that was all. And then when we looked to see what had happened, in fact, the bazooka had hit the very end of the track pin. So in fact, there was 10 inches, 12 inches of armour at that point. And all it had done was exploded on hitting the track pin, and it had damaged the track pin. So in fact, there weren't a super problem, but...
You were very lucky
we were
then.
Terribly lucky, that's why I say I'm lucky at all. I mean, if it had been 6 inches high, I'd be the foot of the base of the turret, or something like that. But anyhow...
Now, you see, there's an explosion. Yeah. Did it shake the tank, or...?
I don't think it shook the tank. There was just an explosion, a flash, or a new one had been hit, but it appeared as though it hadn't penetrated the armour.
And did smoke come in, or...?
No, nothing came in. Nothing
and in. What would have happened if it had hit the base of the turret, basically? What would have...
I don't know.
Would they penetrate a comet's arm?
Well, it might. It depends probably which part of the arm would penetrate. And of course, one thing is about having covers over the outside of the tractor. If it hits the cover, it'll explode at that point rather than against the armor.
So it was all a bit of a lottery with a bazooka hit.
It's entirely. And although people get killed with bazookas, they usually got killed by getting out of the tank. Corporal Bush got out of his tank. The crew were saved. They stayed in the tank. But anyhow, one interesting thing is, we then decided within half an hour, things had quieted down a bit. We got behind the bomb building, and the crew actually took the track off, or under the track, and put a fresh track pin in. Which I think was still a lot for the crew that they could do under those circumstances in a quarter of an hour. It requires taking, rolling the track out completely and running the tank over the track without the track being joined up. So we did very well. But
I want to talk about your relationship with the crew. Yeah, I mean, how close a relationship was it, would you say? Say this crew you had then. I mean, how closely knit together were you?
Well, I suppose my background was different from theirs. I had confidence then, I think they had confidence in me. For a month I'd slept with them in a bivvy beside the tank, I'd eaten with them. We had the same trouble. I hope I was as good a commander as I could be, and they were as good a crew as I could be.
Would things relax a bit in the sense of, would they, what would you call them, by their rank, by their name, or by their surname, or what?
Their surname was.
So it would be Fiddler. I mean, I know he wasn't in your tank, but
yeah, I mean, I didn't, until I met him, I didn't even know what his Christian name was. And I don't know, didn't know the Christian name of most of them. It was always,
And they'd call, what would they call you, sir, or?
I mean, no Christian name or anything like that. They might know I was Tom, and then they probably did know I was Tom.
They would certainly wouldn't call it to your face.
But I took the view that everybody at tank could is independent, and everyone can do the job as best they can. One thing about my crew, I remember there was one occasion when they had liberated something like 17 eggs, and we were going to have them for breakfast. Well, just as they were cooking nicely, I was called off to an O group, which took rather a long time. And when I came back, my driver, I can't remember who it was at the time, had eaten all 13 of the eggs that were left. But I didn't get one. I'm happy to say he suffered for it.
Now, the next thing, back into chronological, I know we keep zipping off to look at other things, but was the crossing of the, just before you crossed the Elbe. I think it says here it's immediately after the incident when your tank was hit.
Yes,
there's a story about you getting a single tracked railway bridge across a canal.
Yes.
If you could tell us about that.
Yes, it appeared actually in this squadron diary as well. We went forward. I found a railway bridge across the canal. I rather thought it was across the Elbe, but obviously the Elbe was somewhat bigger river than I anticipated. And the interesting thing about it was, it was about 3 inches too narrow to get the tank across, because on either side there was a sort of wooden platform. But it was obviously an important bridge which the engineers could have made to cross it. Well, nobody seemed very interested in this bridge. And it was a lovely sunny afternoon, and we were sort of waiting there. We couldn't go across it, just wondering what to do. When suddenly a staff car, I suppose it was a staff car, turned out. And out came the general. I think it was Pip Roberts himself. But certainly the squadron leader had shown no interest in the bridge, and the colonel hadn't shown any interest in the bridge, and therefore we were rather surprised to find that the general in command of the division should appear. But obviously things were rather slack that afternoon, but it cheered the men up no end to have find somebody interested in this bridge, but in fact it came to nothing. The opposite other bridge had been across the canal.
Now, what? Another story. That roughly, is you came across an airfield full of rocket-propelled planes. Would that be around then?
Well, I can't remember where that was, but I think it must have been at this time. It was before the end of the war, and I remember going there, and there were these rocket-propelled planes, little ones. I don't know whether ME-262 or what they were. They were about 15-foot wingspan, but they were piloted, but it took off on from a ramp and landed on a skid with a rocket propelled. But in fact, I gather they were never actually put into action, but there were about 50 of them in this airfield. But I heard no more about it, but it was interesting in what they might have done.
Were you becoming aware that the end of the war was nigh?
Oh, one realised that. The Germans were not really fighting anymore. They were tending to surrender. And after we'd got up to the Elbe by this stage, the Russians were up to the Elbe further down, and the question was where we would meet the Russians, really. But everyone realised it was near the end of the war. And that's why I say sorry about Corporal Bush, because he had been with the squadron from Normandy days. He'd been a tech commander, I think, in Normandy. And he had never been wounded as far as I know. Yet he was always actually killed.
Now, from the 21st to 30th of April, the squadron, which appears to have been detached. I mean, we're looking, we're very A squadron minded, but we'll come back, moved back to join the regiment at Birstall, and stayed there for 9 days while waiting for the crossing of the Elbe. Do you remember that time at Birstall?
Well, yes, in this sense, but once again, we were short of tank commanders, big crew commanders, and there was a training course, and I think at one point David Boller was going to become the squadron leader, and then Bill Hoplett became squadron leader, and we were in a much happier position.
Now, what had actually precipitated the removal of
what? Shoup? I don't know what precipitated the removal of Desmond Shoup, but I think then the realisation that the job was beyond him. And he, after all, he was not a major. Bill Hot Black, his father was a major general, I think, may have been. He was a regular, maybe 50 years. But certainly we were a lot happier with that.
What was Hot Black like? I mean,
I must have known him fairly well, because he was went with me to the he came from a military family. He was quite relaxed, but I mean he was an efficient officer. An efficient fighting officer, really, that's what he was. And I mean he knew what was as far as commanding tanks were concerned.
Were you aware of this training with the Cheshires, the first Cheshires?
Not really. I must say the Cheshires the infantry had become very difficult. They realised the war was ending, and it was very difficult to get them to do anything. It was very clear that the quality of the infantry was not what it had been earlier on.
And you put that down to the fact that they just didn't want to be killed in the last week of the war?
I mean, which is sensible. The infantry never liked tanks because they always just the tank to produce the fire. And the tank didn't mind infantry, but they were always difficult communicating with them. And as a troop leader, you never sort of acted with the same infantry on two occasions. It was a one-off. It depended entirely on who had the lead of the troop present. But on the whole, that is one thing about the way we operated in Germany. We were operating as a tank squadron, and it's very rare that the infantry became involved with us.
You said that they were obviously more nervous. I mean, you said that you were aware of the end of the war. Would you think it was the armour that made that you were less vulnerable in a tank, that made you less?
I'm sure you were less vulnerable. I mean, you aren't vulnerable to anything like the rifle shot. I mean, what I disliked more than anything else towards the end of the war was walking down the street, never being sure which direction the next shot was coming from. In a tank, you've got spoils of armour around you, you've got to have an anti-tank, if anything's going to happen, it's got to be an anti-tank gun or a bazooka. You'd work with the anti-tank gun or tank gun.
So you didn't have the same nerves because you weren't as vulnerable. You didn't see any signs of tank crews hanging back or tanks?
No, never. There were two occasions, I believe, in the Battle of the unit of one of the sergeant who come back right in the early days, and one of the other chap who I've talked about. But those were the only two cases I ever had.
But not in your time?
Not in my time. Well, I say one chap they wanted to palm off on me as a member of my troop to begin with, but the rest of the troop wouldn't have it.
Oh, he was a troop, a tank commander, was he?
No, he was a tank commander.
Oh, just a member of the crew. Yeah, that, I've got you right.
I think some tank commanders would hang back more than others. Derek Coyes, for instance, my true story, he'd been in the war for 6 years, and I mean, I wouldn't be surprised. I wouldn't think that he would have stuck his neck out at that stage. But I mean, I was accepting that.
And just one that it's not a serious thing, but it talks in the thing about a successful Gymkhana, and I just wondered if you remember that and whether you had a go.
I'm not a horseman, I don't remember the Gymkhana. Well, I went to the first I thought of me after being gay day. He certainly tried to teach me to ride a horse, but I tried on two occasions, and that was enough for me.
Now, on you then, on the 30th of April, they moved up to Bardwick with the Cheshires, and then 1st of May, there's reference to 2nd Troop went through and with the infantry captured Fallenhagen. I've not. That's, do you remember that at all?
I can't remember that at all. There was a very little, once we crossed the Elbe, very little opposition indeed. I suppose it might be a bit odd after, but I don't remember firing any shots at that stage at all.
So you weren't doing this business of going down the firing at firing machine guns?
Well, we may have been, but I think by then there were usually when one came to village, one looked to see whether there were white flags outside. And it was nearly always white flags. And the general feeling from the Germans was, well, what we'll turn around and fight the Russians with you.
What was the attitude of the German, and how did you feel towards the German civilians? I mean, did you even see much of them?
Well, we saw very little of them. Never seen any of them at all, actually, I don't think. I mean, I suppose one might occasionally see a farm or something, but I never even seen any of them. But we were very inward-looking, I think, very responding. We looked at the squadron and that was there.
Now, another thing is that I think it's time now to discuss it, but you do have an A squadron perspective of the 5 and 4, 4, 5, I mean the 2nd 5 4 5. Could you just talk a bit about how separate a squadron was from and the limitations on your perspective there?
Looking back on it, the squadron seems to be quite separate from the regiment. I cannot remember any of the officers in any of the other squadrons. I can hardly remember the colonel at all. I remember John Gilbert, who was the second in command.
What was he like?
Well, I don't know much. They were all nice people.
Was the colonel still Scott? I'm not quite sure at the time.
Most of the senior officers, all the old yeomanry officers, they're all Scottish officers. But I suppose about half the men and half the junior officers were English or not Scots by this time. But it's interesting that looking at it, my perspective is entirely a squadron perspective. I never came across the people in the rear echelons, the adjutant. I know Philip knows the adjutant, the adjutant, who the adjutant was, well, I just don't know.
But you did have good links, I mean, you'd have proper links with the other troops in your squadron.
I was friendly with all the other squadron, all the other squadron troop officers. But when you come to think of it, there were only about 6 or 7 of us, and we obviously kept very much to ourselves. But there must have been times when it was easier we saw the other troop officers, but I just don't remember.
Now the last thing, and this is then the advance on the prisoner of war camp. If you could tell that story, you were ordered to advance onto Westerau.
Yes.
I'm not sure what date that was, but
we. This was the same day we went into Lübeck, which would be the 2nd of May. The reason I was chosen was because I had more fuel in the tanks than any other of the other troops in the squadron.
Was fuel a problem?
Fuel was a problem, because they hadn't been, the fuel trucks hadn't been able to get over the bridge at Lauenburg the night before, so we hadn't filled up the night before. And I went out, I don't know what time it was in the morning, to find this prisoner of war camp, which we were told was the place called Westerau, which was two villages in front of the our front line. So I drove off to Westerau in my tank, and Westerau was a small village with about 12 houses, with almost a green area, which was very unusual in Germany. Not a soul allowed, no sign of any prisoner of war camp. So I got out of my tank, knocked out of the door, literally knocked out, so somebody looked out of a window or something, and I said in my German, where the, which was not just where the prisoner of war camp, and they pointed down a side lane, down the side, down the side, which we didn't like the look of very much, because we hated them and sold it. Anyhow, went down it, and after about 200 yards, came to a sign, good pull in the tank, 200 yards ahead.
In English?
In English, yes. And we drove up to the prison war camp.
Who'd put the sign there?
Oh, the prison war put the sign there. They were looking after the Germans, really.
The British, they...
Yes, but the thing was, it was still a prison war camp. And oddly enough, I've heard that since from David Smith, none of them had heard the tanks coming. Therefore, they were quite unprepared. They were so surprised how quiet they were. And so we drove up, and the guards let open the gate or something like that. We drove in.
Absolutely no resistance.
Oh, no resistance at all. And then we had like 800 or 1,000 RAF men descend on our three tanks. Immediately we got there. So were then orders for us to return. Well, it's very difficult to extract oneself from 300 men in your tank. And then there were other problems, like taking over the camp. You see, when you're a lieutenant, you aren't instructed how to take over a prisoner of war camp. And the German etiquette is very strict. It turned out that I thought they were the British chief officer. Senior officer just take over from the German. Oh no, the German wouldn't surrender to the British senior officer. So I had to surrender the German senior officer, the German camp commandant. I handed the pistol over to the British senior officer, now you're in control. And more or less that was that. Well, yeah. By then, I mean, there were all these demands for us to return. And
now, this, which was this prison camp? This was...
Stalingrad 3.
And what were the men doing? The prisoners, rather. I mean, what were they...
I've got an account here from Toby Snail. They had walked from Breslau, Wrocław, in what is now Poland. They walked for 4 months. And they walked towards Bremen. And then the British were coming, so they didn't start walking back yet. Then it stopped in this farm, and they were just waiting there. And actually, if one reads a written obituary of a chap called Sergeant Reed, I think it was, who walked on through the lines and reported where these prisoner of war camps were. Anyhow.
So this wasn't actually the camp, this was just the prisoners from the camp?
No, but it was a camp, because it was a perimeter fence all the way around it. And the camp, it was in a farm. Anyhow.
But it wasn't the original camp.
It's original, it's 500 miles away. Anyhow, we then, the command gets to move. Then I was told one of the tanks had to have changed track. I don't know why it had disappeared. Eventually we got away. I heard about a year ago the reason why the tank had to change a track was that from Gordon Fiddler, that he'd the prisoners failed upon the co-drive